The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngen for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter, and then possibly from the Harvard Health Letter. This is the Harvard Heart Letter of January 2025. And the first article is Seafood Selections That Help Your Heart and Our Planet. Healthy, environmentally friendly options include smaller fish and bivalves like clams and oysters. If you include seafood in your diet, chances are you usually stick with familiar favorites like salmon, tuna, and shrimp. But the next time you visit your local fishmonger or supermarket seafood counter, consider casting a wider net. Choosing seafood that's lower on the food chain, like herring, sardines, clams, and oysters, can benefit your cardiovascular health as well as the environment. Seafood refers to fish and shellfish, but there's a broader category called aquatic foods, which includes any food that comes from marine or freshwater environments. Most people aren't aware of the many different types and advantages of aquatic foods, says Christopher Golden, Associate Professor of Nutrition and Planetary Health at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Both the Dietary Guidelines for Americans and the American Heart Association recommend that adults eat 2 servings of seafood per week. When you use seafood to replace terrestrial animal proteins like beef, pork, and chicken, you consume less saturated fat and more omega-3 fatty acids. That in turn may help ease inflammation within the body and promote a more favorable balance of cholesterol and other fats in the bloodstream. It also may help explain why people who eat fish a couple of times a week are less likely to have heart attacks or die from heart disease than those who avoid fish. Farmed salmon and canned tuna are good alternatives, but including smaller fish varieties in your diet is even better, says Golden. Anchovies, herring, mackerel, and sardines are excellent sources, not only for protein, but also micronutrients like iron, zinc, and vitamin B12, as well as heart-healthy omega-3 fatty acids. Because you often eat the entire fish, small fish are also rich in calcium and vitamin D. Mackerel is an exception. Bones in cooked mackerel are too sharp or tough to eat, although bones in canned mackerel are fine to eat. Small fish are less likely to contain contaminants like mercury and polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, compared with large species like tuna and swordfish. Those and other large fish feed on smaller fish, which concentrates the toxins. Sardine and anchovies are prominently featured in the traditional Mediterranean diet, which is considered the best diet for heart health. Canned versions of these species, which are widely available and less expensive, are a good option. But most canned anchovies are salt-cured and therefore high in sodium, which can raise blood pressure. Sardines packed in water or olive oil can be served on crackers or crusty toasted bread, or prepared like a tuna salad for a sandwich filling. It can also be added to Greek salad. Sardines can be tossed with pasta, either added to tomato sauce or with lemon, capers, and red pepper flakes. Bivalve benefits. Bivalves are 2-shelled aquatic creatures that include clams, oysters, mussels, and scallops. They're good sources of protein but are low in fat, so they aren't as rich in omega-3s as small fatty fish. But bivalves contain several micronutrients, especially zinc and vitamin B12. Zinc contributes to a healthy immune system, and vitamin B12 helps to form red blood cells that carry oxygen and keep nerves healthy. Try canned mussels or oysters on crackers or bread. Many people enjoy bivalves on their own, either steamed, sautéed, or grilled. You can also add them to pasta dishes, salads, or soups. On the whole, aquatic foods generate far fewer greenhouse gas emissions than terrestrial foods. Producing terrestrial proteins like pork, chicken, dairy, and especially beef requires land, water, pesticides, and energy to produce the grain to feed land animals. However, farm-raised fish are also fed grain, plus fish meal made from small fish. That's why wild-caught fish tends to be more environmentally friendly. But eating small fish is an even better choice. Salmon farmers have begun using less fish meal, and some companies have created highly nutritious feeds that don't require fish meal at all. From a planetary health perspective, bivalves are among the best sources of animal-based proteins. Bivalves can be nature positive because they don't require feed and they filter and clean up water. Although we tend to think of coastal cities as the best place to find seafood, it's available throughout the United States. Try larger Asian markets, which often carry a wide variety of fish and bivalves. Also, be sure to follow the FDA's advice about buying and preparing seafood safely. The article goes on to say that perhaps you should sample seaweed selections. You can go even further down the aquatic food chain by eating seaweed. If you like sushi, you probably had nori, the flat sheets of seaweed used to make sushi rolls. You can also find seaweed snacks in Asian markets and many mainstream grocery stores. The truly adventurous may want to try kelp jerky or a kelp burger, both sold online. Kelp is one type of brown seaweed. There are also numerous green and red species. Nutrients in seaweed vary quite a bit, but seaweed is low in calories, is a good source of fiber, and contains iodine, a mineral required to make thyroid hormones. Similar to terrestrial vegetables, seaweeds contain a range of other minerals and vitamins. For now, the various types of seaweed remain fringe products in the United States, but they may become more mainstream in the future. Now we're going to turn in the Harvard Heart Letter of January 2025 to a section called Ask the Doctor. And this is with Dr. Christopher Cannon, who's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Heart Letter. And the question is, after I had a minor stroke, I had carotid ultrasound, which showed an 80% blockage in my left carotid artery. How is this condition treated? And Dr. Cannon responds, the carotid arteries, which run up either side of your neck, supply blood to your brain. Just like the arteries in your heart, these arteries can become clogged with fatty deposits. A stroke can occur if this plaque breaks open and forms a clot that cuts off blood supply to part of the brain, as you experienced. Note that other possible causes of stroke include severe high blood pressure and clots due to atrial fibrillation. Treatment for this problem, known as carotid artery stenosis, includes the same lifestyle habits recommended for people with heart disease, including healthy diet and regular exercise. Cardiologists also prescribe statin drugs, and if needed, additional cholesterol-lowering drugs to get the LDL cholesterol below 70 milligrams per deciliter. This helps to shrink and stabilize the plaque, making it less likely to rupture. Anti-clotting medications like aspirin or clopidogrel, which is Plavix, are also important, as they help discourage the formation of clots. For people like you with symptoms and a blockage of 70% or greater, clearing out the plaque, known as revascularization, makes sense. There are two ways to open a narrowed neck artery. The first way is carotid artery stenting, which involves threading a slender tube called a catheter into an artery at the top of the thigh. The doctor maneuvers the catheter through the blood vessels up to the narrowing in the carotid artery and uses it to place an umbrella-shaped filter beyond the narrowing to catch any dislodged plaque or debris. Once everything is in place, a balloon on the catheter is inflated, mashing the plaque into the artery wall and expanding a small wire mesh tube called a stent. The doctor then deflates the balloon and removes the catheter, leaving the stent in place to hold the artery open. Carotid endarterectomy involves physically removing plaque from inside the carotid artery. A surgeon makes an incision in the neck to expose the artery, clamps the artery, then opens it lengthwise in the region of the narrowing. After scraping the fatty plaque out of the artery, the surgeon enlarges the artery with a diamond-shaped patch, stitches the artery back together, then closes the skin of the neck. The goal is to prevent a future stroke, and both do this quite well, but these invasive procedures sometimes trigger a stroke, which is why they are mostly done in people with severe carotid artery narrowing who have had symptoms. The risk of stroke is low when experienced clinicians perform the procedures in hospitals where these are done often. Now here's a useful article that's entitled Sleep Apnea and Heart Disease, a Weighty Matter. In some people, obesity drugs may improve or even cure sleep apnea, a breathing disorder closely linked to cardiovascular problems. In addition to helping control diabetes and obesity, the powerful drugs known as GLP-1 agonists may also alleviate another disorder that's closely linked to cardiovascular problems, obstructive sleep apnea. And remember, GLP-1 agonists are drugs like Wegovy. This common condition, which is marked by brief pauses in breathing, often accompanied by loud snoring, doesn't just leave people groggy and sleepy during the day. Left untreated, this serious disorder raises the odds of high blood pressure, heart attack, and stroke. Excess weight is the strongest risk factor linked with sleep apnea, which affects about 25% of men and 10% of women in the United States. More than half the people with the condition are overweight or obese, and the risk rises as body size increases, says Dr. Sogal Javaheri, a sleep specialist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Extra fat tissue in the neck and throat can narrow the airway, and extra weight on the chest and belly puts pressure on the lungs, which makes the normal process of inhaling and exhaling less effective, she explains. In sleep apnea, the breathing pauses happen when the airway briefly closes. The first-line treatment is positive airway pressure, which uses a small bedside machine to push a forceful stream of air to a mask covering the nose or the nose and mouth to keep the airway open. A recent study found that one of the GLP-1 drugs, tirzepatide, sold as Mounjaro and Zepbound, can slash the number of breathing interruptions during sleep, a key measure of sleep apnea severity. The June 2024 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, there was a year-long study in which included 469 people with obesity and moderate to severe sleep apnea, some of whom used CPAP machines when sleeping. Compared with people who got a placebo injection, those treated with tirzepatide, remember that's Zepbound, had a nearly 59% drop in their apnea-hypopnea index. a measure that describes the number of times a person's breathing slows or stops during an hour of sleep. Those taking tirzepatide lost close to 20% of their body weight. At least once a week, I see people in my clinic who have lost so much weight on one of the obesity drugs, they don't need to use their CPAP machine any longer, says Dr. Javaheri. Note that the other GLP-1 obesity drug, semaglutide, is sold as Ozempic for diabetes and Wegovy for weight loss. Several patients lost between 50 and 60 pounds, which was enough to completely cure their sleep apnea. While tirzepatide is not approved for treating sleep apnea, it's currently under consideration by the FDA. However, even if you qualify for a prescription for semaglutide or tirzepatide, based on your medical conditions, these medications can be challenging to obtain due to high demand, limited supply, cost, and other factors. That said, the growing list of health benefits from GLP-1 agonists may make them both more accessible and affordable in the future. If and when tirzepatide is approved for treating sleep apnea, sleep medicine clinics will likely provide the medication, says Dr. Javaheri. Weight loss has long been recommended for sleep apnea sufferers who are overweight or obese. After people lose at least 10% of their initial weight, insurance companies usually pay for another sleep study to see if they're improved enough to stop using CPAP, which people find to be cumbersome and inconvenient. But I advise people using anti-obesity drugs to wait until they reach their goal weight before getting retested, says Dr. Javaheri. Finally, it's worth noting that obesity is just one of the factors that predispose people to sleep apnea, which also occurs in people who aren't overweight. Some people are born with anatomic differences that leave them prone to sleep apnea, like a narrow airway, a thicker neck, a larger tongue, enlarged tonsils, or a small receding chin. Smoking also increases the risk of sleep apnea significantly, and alcohol can cause sleep apnea or make it worse. Now we're going to continue in the Harvard Heart Letter of January 2025. And here's an article entitled, What You Should Know About Recalls of Cardiac Devices. Over the years, advances in medical technology have spurred the development of many specialized devices to treat a range of heart-related problems. Devices can trap wayward blood clots, activate receptors that regulate blood pressure, or monitor and correct abnormal heart rhythms. These sophisticated products are very dependable overall. Unanticipated problems can occasionally arise, though, especially in pacemakers and implantable cardioverter defibrillators, which are called ICDs. These feature complex software and circuitry. Following reports of malfunctions, injuries, or deaths, the FDA issues recalls of faulty devices. Each year, Class 1 recalls, the most serious type of cardiovascular devices, affect thousands of people. Among the 157 cardiovascular devices recalled from 2013 to 2022, nearly one-third were implantable devices, and a quarter were designated as life-sustaining or life-supporting. If you're among the millions of Americans who have an implanted heart device, what's important to know? Dr. Daniel Kramer, a cardiologist at the Richard A. and Susan F. Smith Center for Outcomes Research at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, shared his insights. When you consider what pacemakers and ICDs do, it's quite extraordinary. Both have to observe or generate 100,000 heartbeats a day. and respond within seconds to correct an abnormal heart rhythm. Whenever I implant a defibrillator, Dr. Kramer says, I make sure my patient understands that these are very sophisticated devices that work incredibly well, but they're not perfect. In any given year, well under 1% of people with either of these type of devices have any issues. Also, most recalled devices don't need to be replaced. Often the device can be reprogrammed from the outside. Other times, close monitoring is all that is required. Before medications are approved by the FDA for widespread use, most are compared to a placebo or other therapy in multiple studies, including at least one major clinical trial involving thousands of people who are carefully monitored for 1 to 4 years. But that's just not possible with the devices, says Dr. Kramer. It's nearly impossible to do a blinded study since people know if they received a device. Also, it's hard to convince people to agree to participate in a study where a coin toss determines whether they receive a device or not. In some trials, everybody gets a device, but the coin toss determines whether the device is turned on. In addition, people who need heart devices are often older and have complex medical problems. It's difficult to ascribe any problematic outcomes to the device as opposed to the underlying disease. Finally, because complications are so rare, there's no amount of pre-market testing that would allow researchers to predict and document those events. But efforts are underway to improve post-market tracking of device complications. The plan is to use electronic health records, Medicare databases, and registries developed in partnership with manufacturers to more carefully track patient experiences after they receive devices, says Dr. Kramer. Going forward, I'm hopeful these updates will be meaningful for people who live with and depend on these devices, he adds. If you have a cardiac device, keep a record of the make and model number, both on your phone and on a slip of paper in your purse or wallet. In case you ever have to go to an emergency department, having this information handy will also let you easily check if the latest article about a device recall or warning applies to you. If a device is recalled, the manufacturer will contact the device recipients and their doctors. So stay in touch with your primary doctor and the cardiologist who implanted your device. Make sure both know how to reach you if there's a recall. If you move or if you change your phone number or email address, let your doctors know. And there's a small attached article that says, pacemakers and ICDs are small, battery-powered devices placed under the skin just below the collarbone. A pacemaker monitors your heart rhythm and when necessary, generates a painless electrical impulse that triggers a heartbeat. ICDs work much like pacemakers, but they also detect potential life-threatening rapid heart rhythms and deliver a strong shock that jolts the heart back into a normal rhythm. And then here's a short article in the section called Research We're Watching in the Harvard Heart Letter. And it says, flavonoid-rich diet is linked to lower risk of plaque in neck and leg arteries. People who consumed high amounts of beneficial plant compounds known as flavonoids were less likely to have signs of plaque in their leg and neck arteries. Good sources of flavonoids include tea, apples, berries, oranges, and dark chocolate. The study included 5,599 people in the multi-ethnic study of atherosclerosis, a long-running study exploring risk factors for cardiovascular disease. In the early 2000s and again in 2010 through 2011, researchers collected data from food frequency questionnaires and tests that measured the buildup of fatty plaque in participants' heart, leg, and neck arteries. Compared to people who consumed the least amount of flavonoids, those who ate the highest amounts had a 26% lower odds of having plaque in their legs and an 18% lower chance of plaque in their necks or carotid artery stenosis. The study was published in the November 2024 issue of Arteriosclerosis, Thrombosis, and Vascular Biology. And then just briefly, there's an article that says, incorrect arm position may skew blood pressure readings. Letting your arm dangle or rest in your lap during a blood pressure check can cause a falsely high reading. For an accurate blood pressure reading, your arm should be supported so your elbow is at the level of your heart. Researchers recruited 133 adults aged 18 to 80 to study the effects of three arm positions, supported on a desk, resting in the person's lap, or hanging by their side. Lap support overestimated systolic blood pressure by 4 points. A dangling arm overestimated it by 7 points. The error was even greater among people with high blood pressure. Their average systolic blood pressure was 9 points higher when their arm was dangling than when it was correctly supported. Remember, correctly supported means with the arm supported so the elbow was at the level of the heart. And these findings were published online October 7th, 2024, by JAMA Internal Medicine. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.